Well, I thought we'd start by describing your education from the beginning, Horace.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. I like to say I'm the product of the public school systems, but I went to public schools in three different countries, and probably I don't know, maybe a dozen different schools altogether.
Wow!
Because we moved a lot.
Yes.
Moved over 30 times. My family emigrated, and we were what you might call political refugees for a while. So,
yes.
So we were stateless. We didn't have passports. We were officially not citizens of any country. So, for a period of about 4 or 5 years, that was the case. So I started having regular schooling in Romania, and then moved to Italy, and was enrolled in a school in actually in the city of Verona, which is where Romeo and Juliet was originally set. So
I was saying my background. So I spent a year in school in Italy, and I went to school in the north of Italy in Torino, and the thing was that I didn't know Italian, so I actually had to learn, and that's a lot easier for children. I was about 9, I think, and so I learned Italian, was able to have a good school year, but then we moved in the summer, we moved again, and we emigrated to the United States. It took about a year to get the paperwork for that, because that was our ultimate goal, is to be in the U.S. I was enrolled in public schools first in Cleveland, where we found someone to help us. I actually went to, elementary school in the city of Cleveland, where we lived, and then later on for middle school, what happened in Cleveland around that time was the busing started, the desegregation.
Yes.
And it would have meant for me a more than 1 hour journey across the whole city to from the west end to the east end of Cleveland, and my parents would have none of that. So we moved to a suburb immediately adjacent, which is called Lakewood, and so I went to middle school and high school in Lakewood, Ohio, for 3 years in high school, we actually moved yet again to Boston. My father got a job in the booming tech sector at the time, which was in the early 80s, and so I ended up in a suburb of Boston called Medford. We didn't know much. Again, we're flying pretty blind here. We weren't familiar with neighborhoods or what were good schools or anything like that, quote unquote good schools. So it was like mostly it was a question of can we find affordable housing.
Right.
And so Medford turned out to be a pretty lucky choice. I mean, in one hand, at the time it was a blue collar town, it was one of the nearer suburbs, so the closer to the city, that tends to be the older the immigrant generations are. So it was settled mostly by Italian Americans, and so a lot of the children I met in school were some ethnic background. And I again in the Midwest that was a bit more rare. So East Coast for me was a sort of a little bit more vibrant in the sense that there were more interesting ethnic backgrounds and people from different histories and so on. And so I enjoyed, but I only had 1 year at Medford High School. It was actually more enjoyable that year, I would say, than my years in Ohio. But and I have friends that I retained from that 1 year. I don't have friends I stay in touch with from Ohio. But it has changed. The city since has become much more, I would say, a lot of those families moved yet again, probably to a further suburb, and has changed character. I think it's more Hispanic now, the city overall, and nothing wrong with that. It's just it's just probably would feel different to anyone there now. So then I was in Medford, and my next question was where to go to college, and I had been doing okay in school. And that was an interesting puzzle to solve as a kid, because you don't quite know how to fit in, the usual problems. Fortunately, I had, having moved around so much, I was had a pretty thick skin, and having had an accent or a strange background just made you a little bit tougher, and so I was pretty immune to some of the high school politics. So I focused on studies, and my parents are both educators. My father has a PhD in mathematics, and my mother had a master's in mathematics, and she taught. Actually, her job was as a teacher. They both got certified as teachers in the United States. My father had taught also university in Romania, but he ended up teaching high school and other. Like 2-year colleges in the U.S. It's very hard to sort of go into academia from another country. But in any case, the fact that I had such devoted, academically inclined parents helped a lot in sort of focusing me on academics, and that also I think was my nature. But so as far as college. My concern. We always had financial concerns, right?
Right.
And so, for me, I wasn't interested in the social aspect of college. So for us, really, the decision was: can we keep expenses down? And I was accepted at Tufts University and also at Brandeis, which were local. That was important to me. That it would be near to my home, and I could actually commute to these places. And Tufts was slightly better. It was a little bit closer. It was actually in Medford, so I almost went to the college that was nearest to me, and it had a very good program also in both engineering and computer science. So the odd thing is now in college for me was that it's almost accidental, but my they had an option for you to take 2 degrees. And the dual degree program was meant for people to study liberal arts and engineering. And the idea would be you'd be more a well-rounded individual. And the weird thing is that when I went there, which was 1985 to 1989, the School of Liberal Arts included the mathematics department and included computer science department, which is a spin-off of the math department. So computer science was a liberal arts degree, whereas engineering was like electrical, mechanical, and so on, the traditional subjects. So I enrolled in the dual degree program with the intention of obtaining a computer science degree from the liberal arts school and a computer engineering degree from the School of Engineering. And that meant that I would essentially take about 30% more courses. I think it was 50 credits versus the standard 30 or so. So I was going for incrementally more material, but I would end up with 2 bachelor's degrees. And that's what I did. I actually also did it in an accelerated fashion, so I ended up doing that in 3.5 years rather than what they expected it to take, 5 years.
Wow.
So that involved a lot of summer school. I was actually going through taking some of the requirement courses in the summer. So I was basically a student 365 days a year. I managed to get the 2 degrees, and then in the third year I was an intern at one of these internship opportunity for a research lab, GTE. And GTE Labs was again local, which was important to me. But they actually put us up in the dorm. So the only time I spent living in the dorm was during the summer of my internship. Because it was paid for by the employer, And that was a great time. I absolutely adored it. So I was actually in my third year, which actually was my second year, as I was a junior a bit early. I was going through this internship and I was studying. I was going working in a research lab, and then I ended up doing my senior year, my last year. I kept going back there. Somehow they kept me around as a part-time employee because the project I had been on turned out to be useful. It was in the library. I was actually working on indexing, which turned into search, which turned into Google later on, but we didn't know what it was then. We called it information retrieval. And the algorithm, so I understood sort of search intuitively when it actually became a commercial product, but it was something we did as research back then. And it was great because I was getting the experience I wanted, desperately loved it, and then I was still in school and I managed to get my degree, and I was even earning money while I was doing this. So it worked out very well, but it was a very tough period, and I graduated with not the highest scores, but I think I was magna cum laude or something like that, which is not summa cum laude, but it's like pretty good. It's like 3.8 GPA or something like that. But that's it. I don't know if that's what you wanted to hear. That was my. Then, of course, I did grad school.
Right.
2 years while I was still employed. So I took a full time job at the labs. Then I did essentially I did 2 years. So in 92, I got my my master's in computer engineering. And then I spent about a year or two figuring out what to do next. I went to New York to do a bit of have a bit of experience because, I remember. So I applied to Harvard because I wanted to go to business school. And the reason I wanted to go to business school is I didn't understand business.
How did that play out? MBAs are often criticized.
I'll tell you how it played out. Because first thing is this. I'm sitting with my friends. We're all engineers, hackers, if you will. And we're like, we don't understand how we get funded. I mean, here we are sitting in these nice offices, but how does this company who's, basically a boring utility, how are they going to just like fund us to do cool stuff? So we just compared notes and nobody knew. I realized that none of us knew how business worked. And I said, I better learn about this. To me, I had been so focused in engineering that all this business stuff, the only thing I knew is like because I could read the Wall Street Journal. It wasn't like I didn't have either friends, acquaintances, families. All my friends were nerds. All my family were, educators. And I knew nobody, literally not one person, who could tell me how the stock market worked. I would pick up the Wall Street Journal, read it cover to cover, and I wouldn't understand what the heck they were talking about. It sounded very abstract to me. It sounded like I need to learn something, that there was something missing in my education. So I felt that the only way to get that training was to go to business school. And so I applied. I was rejected. And the assumption was in my mind that I didn't, that was too technical, right? Too focused and in a very, very narrow niche. So that's when I, that back then it was like there were headhunters that were trying to headhunt people. So one headhunter got a hold of me and they said they had an opportunity in New York. And I said, oh, New York, I know they do business in New York. So I better learn more from going to New York. And so I took a job with Chase Manhattan. At the time, it's called something else now, but it was Chase Manhattan, and the job was also in IT, but at least it was IT, more pragmatic, corporate technology, they call it. But I was there trying to understand more about business. So I'd still read the Wall Street Journal every day, still wouldn't understand it, and I reapplied to business school. I told them what I did. I said, look, I took this job because I wanted to learn business. I think I somehow convinced them the second time because I was so mad, to do these kind of things that
right,
they
persistent, yes,
persistent, and somehow I got accepted. I never know how they made that mistake, but anyway,
yes, of course.
Once I went there, I was like, okay, teach me. Now the problem was that you start to learn with the case method, and you realize pretty quickly that there is no real curriculum. This is actually a lot of examples you're being given. It's not even empirical. It's like, let's throw a lot of examples and see if something makes sense in the pattern somewhere.
And this is Harvard.
Yeah. So Harvard Business School. It was the only school I applied to because I felt, I didn't know how to qualify quality in terms of business. I mean, right, there was just the brand name. And it's like, if you know nothing about phones, you just buy the iPhone because you know it's the best, right?
Right.
So that was me, very naive. And you know, throughout the school, it wasn't as rigorous. In many ways, it was easy, because in engineering is very hard. You have to take tests and you have to get answers right. And in business school, it seemed like you just had to talk and you had to be articulate and you had to somehow be sufficiently smart sounding to succeed.
The theater aesthetics.
Yeah. So there was they drilled that into you. They said that what we're teaching you is how to basically be a leader, and that leadership meant being proactive, not being passive. It meant getting in, if you will, on the discussion. And I got that. I got it, and it made sense to me because in the meeting, you know, if you sit there and say nothing, probably no one pays attention to you. You won't go anywhere in life. So that was one of the lessons. The other ones were about vocabulary. You know, what are that we're not learning here, that there's axioms. There's no specific rules of business. In fact, if you were to put them down, there'd be many which would contradict each other. You know, one of the classics is like, money now is better than money later. But you need money now in order to have money later. So, you know, these two things are contradictory, right? So yes. There were no rules in business that made any sense, as if you're proving a theorem or something like that. So I decided, all right, let's just go with the flow. And I met nice people. I learned more from a lot of people. And the best thing that happened to me is that I had Clay Christensen as a professor. And he was the nicest guy. And he had a the way he taught, it just resonated with me. A lot of the things he was saying, he hadn't yet published The Innovator's Dilemma. He was only teaching us operations, which is a first year course. And it's basically the only technical course, in the sense that you learn, you do some process diagrams and you do some analysis. Finance is another sort of analytical course, but the math is pretty straightforward. And it's not very conceptual in a way. And accounting is not either, in the sense of, it's interpretation. But this professor Christensen was just he had a way of speaking to me that kind of made sense as an engineer, it wasn't just me. There's a lot of people in the class who just felt that this guy was getting to the heart of a lot of the questions that we had. And so I took him as much as I could. I also had the option to take him in the second year, but unfortunately, there was a change in the dean, and so he actually, I think, had to change courses that he was teaching the second year. But in any case, so we had a good 2 years there. And my question then was, what do I do after I graduate? And everybody at the time, this is 1996, the internet was just emerging. You know, Netscape existed as of 1994 or 1995. There was no internet per se. Certainly there was a technology industry, but it was pretty much boring, and either IBM or you know, commodity PCs, and you had a bunch of software companies like Microsoft and Adobe, and it was pretty already kind of getting a little bit tired as an industry. If you wanted to be, you know, as an MBA, it wasn't really that exciting. So everybody was doing either consulting or investment banking, right? But those were the typical ways of getting out of school. And I, of course, did something different. I did a startup, and nobody. And in fact, I told people I wanted to do a startup, and everybody said, "Well, you came to the wrong school. You know, no one goes to Harvard to learn how to do a startup. You know, there are specific schools that do train you for entrepreneurship, like, for example, Simmons or something. I forgot the names now." Or maybe that's a women's college. I don't remember the names. But the point is that the guys were saying, no, this is you come out of here, you either going to be a CEO one day of a Fortune 500 company, or you're going to be a consultant for life, or you're going to be other people's money by the private equity. Or I was like, oh boy, all right, well, whatever. So I went and did a startup, and I was like, you know, I did a startup with no VC money. It was done with a partner in California who had raised money from the government using SBIR grants.
Right.
So this was like Department of Defense, and we were doing algorithms research. I went back to my university and recruited an engineer who I worked with in the basement office right off of Massachusetts Avenue. And, you know, that was in 96. And we built a system. We ended up actually licensing it to Adobe. It was a plug into Acrobat. We didn't benefit much from it financially. Other people made a lot of money, but not us. But we did learn a lot. And I was still. So I'm thinking in business school, I didn't really learn how business works, but I kind of have this degree, which gives me credibility. Now I'm going to do my own business.
It's a ticket horse, yes.
Yeah. But I did my own business. I threw away the ticket. Yes. I did my own business, and then it didn't matter. You know, it didn't help me at all. What I was realizing, for example, I didn't know how to do sales, and I thought when you're doing your own business, you actually need to know sales, and they don't teach you that at business school. So I actually went and took sales courses. You know, like they do for what, a day-long seminar.
Sure.
And I'm saying there's so many pieces that are missing. I didn't know how VCs, how to handle VCs and how to do pitches and do all these things. And none of that was taught. So I thought, okay, what I'm going to do, on-the-job training. I'm going to figure this out. And then networking with people in technology. And eventually I decided from the learning we had in the first startup to do another one, to do e-books. And that was 1999. So I'm trying to do ebook startup, and I'm on a standards body. I'm doing something with folks, and I'm actually in a standards group that includes people from Microsoft, from Adobe, from a bunch of other startups, and from Nokia. And actually, that's where I met someone from Nokia. And at the time, it was 1999. And I realized at that moment. Without Nokia, I said, "Well, all computers are going to be handheld devices." Yes. This is so obvious. I mean, I can't express how obvious it is.
Yes.
And I was interested because Nokia had pretty much at the time the best mobile devices.
Yeah, they were the player, no doubt.
And I was asking myself, "Look, everybody in the U.S. doesn't get mobile. It's obvious that either it's Japan or Europe." Yes. And so my question in my mind was, "Do I stay with the technology industry and try to figure out how this mobile computing will play out, or do I go to somebody who really knows mobile and expect that they will actually figure out how to become a computing company?" So I chose the latter, partly because they also offered me a job, and then the dot-com bubble burst, and I wasn't ever going to get funding for my ebook business.
Yeah.
Which was called Handheld Media. It was a great idea, a great business idea, that we would actually help publishers convert books, because right. At the time, the publishing workflow didn't include you know, exporting tools. You either went to print or PDF, and we had this tool that would reformat a book into a publishable format, like what is EPUB now.
Right.
At the time, it was called OEBF, Open eBook Format. It was an HTML variant, and I actually had a workflow I could execute on my own, and I could basically produce eBooks. And I did a couple of dozen, mostly as trials. And I remember them even now, actually going through and manually extracting hundreds of pages fairly quickly, though. But anyway, that was all came crashing down because although ebooks were still interesting, there was no more funding, and the
right.
Doc ended. And so I had the opportunity to work with Nokia because they were actually very interested in launching something, not necessarily in ebooks, but in media distribution in general. So they wanted to sell music, they wanted to sell video, they wanted all those things in 2000. Mm-hmm. And I came to them, you know, with my now I'm playing my ticket, my ticket. You know, they said, "Well, you must something about how to do business strategy." So they hired me, and I had this technical background as well, and so 1 year I spent based in Boston. But then I was fairly quickly moved to Finland, because that's really where you need to be to have a really any career opportunities. And I was young. I was not married, and Finland has its charms. So another American expat who had moved there before I did, and he extolled its virtues, and so I was pretty sold on that. And so even though you pay more taxes, you get less wages, everything I did was economically the wrong thing to do. Every step along the way.
That's a learning, though, too. I mean, you've learned a lot. So looking back on all that, Horace, what might have been better or more effective when you think about your kids today? You know, what...
I know I'm probably, you know, having too long of a chat on this, but I mean, playing around this, but yeah, I'm very conscious of education, as I said, and I realized pretty much after a year. Let me, you know, when I started Asimco, it's very weird again that you never know when you start down a journey where you're going to end up. When I started, it was purely going to be a web development because apps were just starting out, and apps were really almost invisible, or there was no development going on in Europe. So my idea was, why don't I bring iPhone apps into the land of Nokia, because here there's going to be, you know, it's a greenfield site.
Yes.
But it was a tough sell. I mean, I got one customer, but it was very, very tough. I wanted to bring apps to small and medium companies. I was going to essentially do apps as marketing material, you know, yes. Like these apps that are essentially branding kind of thing. But I was naive also about the Finnish business culture, because I think small businesses are extremely conservative, and that wasn't playing out. But the fortunate thing was that I began to blog, because I had blogged while I was inside Nokia, and I told that story about how I started doing it because I realized that I wanted a bigger audience.
Yes.
And then when I left, people kept saying, why don't you do that while you're on the outside just for fun? And I took that year to figure the things out. So I went back to writing my blog. And literally everything was happening like in 20 minutes. I'd be like, oh, I should blog again. Okay, let me blog. How do I do this? So I'm learning everything, single thing, because I had done it inside. It was movable type. It was a completely different system. I didn't have to set up anything. It was very simple. It was done for me. But on the outside, I'm having to do it all myself. So I started using actually iWeb, which at the time had a blogging tool. Yes. So I opened an account, Mobile Me, and I was just putting everything through the desktop tools there right under my nose. And then I realized the limitations of that, and I moved to the next thing. I was like, oh, it seems like WordPress is something people use. Let's go to that. So I went to WordPress, and then I realized, oh, hang on. If they're hosting me, they're going to put ads on my stuff, and I don't know what they're put there. So I better myself, how do you do that? Oh, I need to find a hosting provider. Oh, how do you do that? So every technology, every bit of knowledge I had to have, I obtained strictly on my own. So yes. I say that every single character written into Asimco and every single mouse click that made it possible was initiated by me. I had no technical support at all. It helps maybe to have a computer science background, but years have passed then. So I was able to. So here's the key to the whole thing is that. So every step I'm learning, I'm like, oh, I understand how this works. And I had some friends who were more technical, and I would ask them, and they say, oh, you're wasting your time. There's no, you know, you can't get any traffic. This won't work. Tell me about Twitter, and they would say, oh, you're better off on Facebook. And I was like, oh, man. So every single thing that I was given as advice turned out to be that if I did, it would actually be the right thing.
Yes.
And so I started to learn about stats, the numbers game of blogging. So how does that work? What does it mean to have good traffic? I didn't expect to get advertising revenue, but I was like thinking that, you know, what does it mean to be successful? So I would go to John Gruber's site, and John puts up his own rates, and I'm like, oh wow, look at the numbers. He actually tells you how much he charges per week, and then he says he's fully booked, so you know what his income is. And so from that I was like, wow. So that's my goal, I said to myself. If I can get the traffic that Gruber gets, then I can charge these rates.
Yes.
And so I was trying to figure out how much traffic he was getting. He was getting like 4 million page views a month. And I said, I don't know if that's a lot or not. It sounds like, well, it certainly is a lot to get money, but you know, how do I get from 0 to 4 million? So so what happened is that also when I was starting out, I reached out to John by saying by email, and I said, you know, I used to work at Nokia, and there's a couple of things you were writing about that I wanted to amplify, or I wanted to give you some background on. It's a great stuff, and he actually used my material in one or two blog posts. Okay, and so I wasn't blogging at that moment. But once I started blogging, I mentioned to him, I said, remember me, you know, I sent you that info, and yes. Now my own blog. And so he said, you didn't say anything, but then I wrote something. I think the first piece that I wrote that was provocative was like, why someone at Microsoft had been fired or something like that. And he linked to me, and then I saw then my eyes were open, because then my traffic went up from 0 to 12,000 a day.
Yes.
And 12,000 for me was was like infinity. So my server crashed and all that. So I went back and I said, thanks for the traffic. Now what do I do? Because I need money to be able to get this traffic managed. And he said, no, you don't need money. You need to turn on caching. I was like, oh. So he said, solve the problem. But then I was asking him, so where do I go from here now? I mean, should I think about putting ads on my site? Is that the right thing? Because I was so naive. And he said, no. He gave me one piece of advice. The only piece of advice I ever got from him that was, and from anybody that was useful, was he said, don't put ads. Just do what you do. The future, your value is in the future. Just keep doing what you're doing. That's all he said, was one line. And I said, okay, if he says that, I believe it. That makes sense. Let's do it. And so I kept getting better at what I was doing, basically writing as well as I could, getting the feedback from comments, and learning every step of the way. It's still going on. I mean, one year on, I learned Twitter. I didn't know what Twitter. You know, the first thing I learned on asymconf was what a hashtag is good for. It's the first time I knew what it were. I never used a hashtag before asymconf, because I don't search. I don't use Twitter that way. I don't use it to look up stuff, or I mostly use it as a way to get my word out and get feedback, just like a mini microblog. But then I didn't understand the potential of the hashtag, and then it sort of like dawned on me when people were writing about asymconf and using a hashtag, and thus, you know, if I searched on that, I could find out everything that everybody said about it, yes. Which is a great idea. But that I learned again just a few days ago, and so many things I learned, thousands and thousands of details, that now people, the tables are turned. Now people expect me to teach them about
yes,
and get traffic. And you know, a lot of people are sending me emails with paragraphs and paragraphs of effusive. You are so great. Oh, thank you so much. Can you help me with this? I'm like, oh, you don't need to say any of those thank you things. Just tell me what you need, right? So, you know, a 15-year-old sent me a request. You know, can you answer some questions from me? And I like your blog. So, sure. You know, answer 5 questions. And I treat everybody equally, because you know, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or a 15-year-old, to me, I give them equal attention. There's no, I learn as much from both. So, yes. You know, the kids will teach you more, actually. So,
given all of that, if you were entering college today, what would you study, Horace?
I would still study engineering. Absolutely. I'm at heart an engineer. My son, I hope he does the same things I do. I was a kid and I loved building things. I loved building Lego, though I didn't have money for a lot of them. And I loved building model kits, you know, the little plastic model kits. Planes and so on, and that's not fashionable anymore, and mostly it's old men who do it nowadays. I'm trying to teach my kid, and I actually bought a whole bunch of kits and began to model again so he could see me do it, and so he would get a passion for it, because I think building things with your hands, learning how things work, being passionate about numbers and about technology and things that you know, things that are tangible is the only way to really create. If your mind works that way, obviously I'm not saying it's for everyone, but to me that's the heart and soul of progress. And again, the funny thing is, by the way, I didn't mention this, but my parents also infused in me a love for the arts, and not modern. They, you know, being Romanians and of a certain age, they weren't ever part of the rock and roll, if you will, generation, although, you know, they knew of the Beatles. So they listened to classical music, and so throughout my life I was exposed, and I was taken to theater, opera, ballet. I used to sit in these performances since I was, you know, 5 years old, and so I was, you know, I maybe didn't get it. I wasn't talented. You know, I tried to play the violin. I wasn't good at it, but I understood. After repetition, I understood the value of that, and I went to that liberal arts college and got my degree, even though it was in computer science, I had a lot of requirements. I had to take English poetry. I had to take Japanese art. I had to take a lot of courses that were basic requirements. And at the time, they were a burden. But in retrospect, they actually taught me a great deal. And I'm very proud of having that background. So I'm not saying to not have an arts education, but I would absolutely, if you have the skill and can execute or can perform as an engineering student, do that and do the other things. Do the other things which develop the other half of your brain. So,
where did you learn to write, Horace? You write very well, and you are able, especially given that English is not your first language, you're able to be succinct, and you have a wide-ranging command of the language. So where did you learn that?
Reading, partly. Okay, so I have to give a lot of credit, and I did once on Twitter give a credit to my English high school teacher.
Wow.
And I said, if you like the writing I have on Asimco, you should thank her. But actually, I wrote to her, and she had seen my work in the Boston Globe. It had been syndicated from Bloomberg or something. And related, wrote me an email saying, I'm so proud to see your work. And I sent it to your calculus teacher as well. They were both retired, and they, you know, the calculus teacher had seen my work in the financial section, actually, and he sent her a note saying, check out the book. And they read the paper. These are from that generation, right?
Yes.
Never seen my work in print. I've seen it online, but there was. And I said, I thanked her. What I said is this, what she taught me, was to write plainly, write clearly. And this is Medford High School, a working class neighborhood, nothing special about it. The teachers I had in English in Ohio didn't instill in me the same passion. Now, the works were the same books were read, right? The same
classics, yeah.
Twain and Conrad and all those classics. But the teacher in Medford just when I would write an essay, and also I think there was positive feedback because I was perhaps a little bit better than average in her class than I was in Ohio. I was about average maybe, but I had good grades, but I didn't feel I was great at it, and I was nervous because a lot of the tests were vocabulary or a lot of the tests were not essays. But this teacher instilled in me the passion for writing good essays. And she kept telling me how great my essays were. And because I was writing somehow, and I loved reading the books, that's the other thing. The other kids would like cheat. They would read the Cliff Notes and
yes,
copy each other or do all these things. And I was like, no, I want to go home and I would really want to read this book. These are really nice books. And so a lot of reading, a lot of passion for reading, and I think practicing with essays and practicing also in the writing of work online. Now, again, it didn't. When I look back at my early stuff, I cringe. It took me a while to find my voice. I didn't know what a voice was. Figured that out quickly. Then I had this challenge of working in the rigor of data, because I realized the way to make my stuff stand out was to avoid opinion, to avoid hyperbole, to avoid all these things which bloggers seem to do. It took some time. I think there's both a lot of ability, like Einstein said, you know, it's 20% ability, 80% perseverance or perspiration.
Right.
And it just practice. And the other thing is, it's like an athlete, right? An athlete gets good because they practice every day. And when I set out, I said, you know, this is so much fun. I want to keep to it. I want to write a story every day. I want to write a blog post every day. And I pretty much stuck to that. I was even writing on weekends, but I stopped. I'm family. But I write every day, and I think of it as a mental athleticism. You've got to go running every day if you want to be an athlete. You've got to write every day if you want to be a writer. Heard later on, Jerry Seinfeld said he wrote every day. That was his key to success. He always tried to write jokes every day. And that, to me, is what I learned. And you develop, you bite your tongue sometimes. You learn how to deal with comments. You learn through comments. You see exactly how people make mistakes. They make mistakes by getting ahead of their of their thoughts, or they're too impulsive, and you get this great sense of what makes a good. And I find myself being able to write things. I write email in a good way, crisp in the email. I'm able to say, if somebody sends me copy, like now I have the sponsor, and they send me copy, and I cringe when I look at it. I said,
I noticed that.
I can't help myself. I actually get their copy, and even though they probably don't want me to, there's no time to go back and do a feedback loop. But it's something you learn as a skill. Yes. I think some other people have asked me, how can you teach my son to write well? And to me, it's not about being able to do more. It's actually being able to cut out less and just go straight from thought to word. And it's hard, but maybe it takes practice.
So now that you're a parent in Finland, you have children in Finland, so what choices do you have for your kids' horse?
We're very conscious of that. So I like Finland. I came for one reason, because it was a wonderful place to play, but I stayed because it's a wonderful place for families. And what Finland's known for, among other things, but one of the things it's known for is that it has the best scoring students on test scores, right, for international. So their educational system is considered absolutely, in the top, literally top of the world. And there's a lot of mystery about why that is. You can't really put your finger on it. A lot of educators from Finland have been on world tours trying to explain what they do, and everybody comes away scratching their heads. And I think this actually goes back to a lot of the Christensen theory, because when you study it, people want to see a formula or an algorithm, but in fact what's happening is something about whether the system is integrated or modular, whether the system is centralized or decentralized. So it's not a question. It's like when he approaches healthcare, he comes at it from these two different angles. It says it's not about being public or private, it's being modular or integrated. And this distinction, the assumption is always that everything is modular and it cannot be anything else. So in a sense, you need to question down at the deeper roots of causality. One thing that so my son, to just give you some perspective, he's now in preschool, he's six now, or is grade zero, as they call it here, and he's going to a French school, meaning they speak French in class,
right, all the immersion school, yes,
and there are several languages. Language schools like this. We're going to the French one partly because his mother went to a French school, his uncle went to a French school, and they have loyalty to it. But also because I personally like for him to learn a Romance language, because I knew one, or I did, I still know Romanian, and I had learned Italian, and I took French in school myself. The thing is that it doesn't cost any more to go to that school to any other school, so all education is free. There are some ways to there, not everybody can get into any school, but it isn't about money. The other thing is that it's a small nation. There's only about 5 million people, and so they can make everything. All the decision making can be centralized. So there's no local school boards. There's no organization down to the smaller units that you might imagine. It's very simple. It's top down. If you were to try to do a top down approach for countries big as the United States, it wouldn't work, right? So you can't really transplant the system. People are very wary of centralization and control and the decision making at the top that is incompetent, and I completely understand that. However, this is being a small nation, it works, and it's central. There's a question of optimum size. I mean, in some sense, 5 million may be the right, maybe 8, even 10 million maybe works, but I don't know about beyond that. And also the question of how different the people are in terms of homogeneity. Although Finns are fairly homogeneous, there are minority groups as well, and there's plenty of immigrants. So I'm not an expert on any of this, but I'm just pointing out some minor details. I really like the school system. We actually had a parent-teacher meeting this morning. They're very relaxed. Children seem to be much more relaxed. And this is one thing that came across from the educators meeting and discussing. There's no pressure. There doesn't seem, even though they're very performing exceptionally well, there doesn't seem to be that pressure on testing, on measurement, on all of these things that supposedly correlate with performance. So in many ways, it's asymmetric, or it's not doesn't make sense to people who are steeped in education theory. So I don't know if that's advisable, though. I mean, the problem again is that it may only work in this context. It may only work in a Nordic country. But we're very happy with the way it works. The same thing, by the way, with healthcare. Healthcare here is also centralized. It is a public resource.
So what's your sense of the teachers you've encountered? I mean, I know one of the things The Economist reported a couple of years ago was that Finland requires master's degrees from teachers. I mean, do you have, and contrasting that with what you experienced in America and Verona and Romania, you know, do you have a sense of differences in the teacher capabilities or no?
Because here, mostly all degrees are considered masters. It's essentially, I think, 5 years of school of education. But there's so many differences that I can't even begin, because my wife, for example, she has a master's degree. A bachelor's degree would be more equivalent to like a 2-year college in terms of perception. So if you have a technical, but a lot of people drop out even, so they get nothing, because it is somewhat more long and tedious, and it is also not conducted in the American style of sort of valuing. Let's put it, it's so hard to explain. I actually would like him to go to university in the U.S., but I'd like him to go to every other school in Europe or in Finland more specifically, because I think the U.S. higher education system is better. It's better because it actually doesn't teach you according to a cookbook. It's actually much more open. And in a way, that's the opposite on the lower grades. The lower grades are open in a way, and the students are given a lot more freedom, and the teachers are given a lot more freedom. And so it's the opposite. And you'll see this also like in Japan. Japan's educational system is a bit of a joke, because they drill so hard in order to get a good scores and get into a good university. But once they get into the university, they do nothing. It's that is, the entry is your ticket. And after that, there's hardly any. So that it's I've heard from others that the way university schools programs here are, many students will stay in like for 6, even 10 years. It takes a long time, because they'll drop in and out. They'll take a couple of courses. They'll do something else. It isn't rigorous in the sense of, hey, the clock is running. This burns a lot of money. You got to get a job to pay off loans. You've got that, because you've got that pressure on you in American universities. I think people actually get through it faster. It's more efficient, and also I think it tends to also draw more talent into it. The professors are more ambitious, and there's something I like about the U.S. higher education system, although if you listen to Clay, you know, he'll say that it's also being disrupted, and he's probably right. Especially the bigger names are going to be pressured from online education.
So what, given your steep experience in technology and engineering, what is the role, or is there a role for technology in education? I mean, certainly in America and other countries, we have all these people who say, gee, you know, our kids don't have iPads, you know, they're just falling behind, you know, among other things. And so what's your perspective on that, Horace?
Well, technology is useless without, software. I mean, hardware is useless without software, and computers are useless without a job to be done.
Yes.
And the is that, I believe technology help, but we have to make sure we solve the job problem with technology, rather than saying that technology itself is this answer. And I think the iPad has potential because it enables the content to come through again. And what you might learn by using it is focused on the content itself. In other words, a computer was always hard to use, and most of the time you spent using it was actually learning how to use it. So you have to fight through it to get to the actual content and material that was supposed to teach you something. Even the way it used to be that, you know, there was a computer room or a computer lab, and you would go and sit in front of these computers, and there were all these things that in other words, it got in the way. And I think that what technology needs to do is be more pervasive, and you need to give the platform to someone who can build something on top of it, someone who can actually create new content, new material, new ways of teaching. And the real innovations that I've seen, I think, have been like the Khan Academy or even TED Talks or something along the lines of video content that's packaged in small pieces that people can take and learn at the rate that they're comfortable with. That makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know how that can be worked into K through 12 system because it that's so regimented. But I think kids having iPads seems to be potentially a breakthrough opportunity there for how to really teach. But it's all going to come down to the materials. Is this a platform that teachers can build stuff on? And the only thing I have to criticize the system for is that it's still not possible for a layman to create material for it. We need more and better tools that sit on top of the tools we have, right? So abstract hardware, so you can create great ebooks, you can create
interactive
experiments, and so on.
Right.
Well, that's great. I appreciate your time today, Horace, and perhaps we can continue this again one day on education, which certainly continues to change. And again, good luck with the French school with your son.